If you remember, Davy Jones had tasked me with sharing with you the secrets of the sea, and you learned all about the fundamentals of waves and currents and how we deal with them. And I went back and I reported to Dave that you were all so excited of what you'd learned. And he said, "Jack, you didn't tell them why we have to worry about those things." So he sent me back here again to now explain why all these rules and guidelines have been created. So that's my mission for the next hour, to try and back up and fill in a little of the holes that I might have left unanswered last time we talked. I will also sell from a self-serving perspective that over the past year I had a chance to do a little bit of expert witness work, being challenged by those lawyers. And I discovered that maybe there were some things that are even deserving of a little bit more explanation from a lawyer perspective. So we're going to try and mingle all of that in. Now, what I'm talking about today is codified in really two publications. One is the American Society of Civil Engineers Manual 50 on the design of small craft harbors. And I'm sure every one of you have a copy of that on your bookshelf. And for those of you who have the international twist on it, there is also the PIANC, which is the Permanent International Association of Navigation Congresses Manual on Marina Design. Now, what's important to understand about that is that ASCE says about this manual, it's a manual that provides state-of-the-art guidelines for planning, design, and development of small craft harbors. Great. But they are very quick to say it is not, in any sense, a standard. Now, when you're in front of a judge and they're looking for something like a building code, this is not to be interpreted as a building code. PIANC says a similar thing. The objective of their report is to provide information and recommendations on good practice. But conformity is not obligatory. So again, this is not a building code. In fact, I will tell you there is nothing in the marina industry that is really a building code. It's all guidelines and standards. Conformity is not obligatory, and engineering judgment should be used in this application. Now, that was kind of a self-serving remark to make sure you hire me. But the report should be seen as simply expert guidance on the state of the art. What I want to then tell you is, do not tell a lawyer about that. Here, let's talk a little bit about the applicability and limitations of what the manual is and isn't. First, it was written intending to be for the use and design of marina systems that act as a single operating unit, that not necessarily adjacent independent entities. There's a lot of cases when you have two marinas side by side. You may just simply have two properties side by side. There is no guidance in the manual, and there is rarely any guidance in the law as to what happens, how those two independent groups interact. Do you have to allow navigation corridors between adjacent properties? Does what you build have to impact or not impact your adjacent property owner? Those are always big issues. They are not considered part of the marina guidelines, even though we use common terminology. Here's a very simple example. What is a fairway? Well, in vernacular terms, we all understand a fairway is that corridor, that aisleway that our boats run up and down. But how it is interpreted, how it is used, can be many different ways. Is it actually the clear distance between any opposing berths? Or must it be straight and continuous? Those numbers and dimensions can vary all over the place. So there's all sorts of legal ramifications. If you find yourself in a legal situation, these will be coming challenging things. And I will warn you, the guidance is not in the manual on that. So what we are talking about when you're looking at the rules in the manuals, or not rules, excuse me, looking at the guidance in the manuals is intended to be for you as a single operating unit and how your system would work. So, this is where we want to make sure that we don't put any of our guidance in the hands of lawyers, because they will totally twist it around far beyond the intent it was ever written. So what I want to do then is let's go back and let's define again, what is our marina? Now, you guys have seen this before, so you're going to be able to answer before I even put it up here. But just as a refresher, our first thing about the marina, and we need to think heavily about this, is the approach to our marina. Just because the physical bounds of our marina may be small, that doesn't mean that we don't care about what the vessels are doing as they're trying to approach or leave our marina, and we don't care about the environment that may exist out here. So effectively, your marina has influence or is influenced by things way far afield from where you are. A critical aspect of your marina is what happens right in the marina entrance. That is the most critical, the most unsafe part of your entire marina. That's the place where boats have to slow down to make an entrance. That is a place where you may have congestion. You'll have passing traffic. Many things can happen right there. So this is your most dangerous spot. You certainly care and focus most often on what happens inside your marina basin. That's where all your dockage is. That's where all the activity occurs. And then because putting a marina someplace has adjacent effects, we have to understand what's going on in the adjacent shorelines, whether you are causing harm or maybe you're causing good. You have neighboring properties that are affected one way or the other by your facility. So as we look back at how we are, what are we going to design to? What are we going to worry about? A big thing is we got to worry about the fact that we get wave reflections or current diversions that are happening out here as our boats are trying to make entrances and egresses from our facility. All of this influences the safety of your boater. There is this thing called amplification. All sorts of nasty things happen right in the marina entrance. Again, we are actually, by the sheer creation of your facility, causing that to happen. And ultimately, we have to worry about how do any of these effects out here end up entering into our marina and what happens to us then. So let's look at how approaching and entering a marina may play into this. Well, reduced speed and there's less maneuverability happens in an entrance. It's congested by boat traffic, and there are natural and induced agitations from shore and shore structures. If someone has built a dock opposite yours, you may very well get currents being deflected off of that dock into your entrance. You may get waves deflected off of it. There may be ice effects coming in. So all of these things, whether natural or man-made, can happen, right? And they all will always focus and magnify right at your entrance. If we want to talk about reflections, it turns out that as waves come in, and they hit our breakwater, they hit our floating attenuator, they even hit the shoreline, they are going to reflect back in some way. When they reflect back, they actually add together with the waves that are coming in. So you get a zone right at your entrance, right at your breakwater, right at your shoreline, that is actually more agitated than the waves out in the middle of the lake, out in the middle of the ocean. I want that to sink in for a second. You actually have a zone where it is worse right there than it is farther afield. So how far does that reflection zone happen? Well, it happens at about 1 to 2 what we call wavelengths. You hopefully will all remember from previous discussions what a wavelength is. It's the physical length between any two adjacent waves. And I am just for guidance purposes suggesting that the typical wave, whether it's a boat wake or a non-hurricane kind of wave, a storm wave, that a marina might be dealing with or worrying about is on the order of 100 feet. So that says that you have a physical danger zone of 100 feet to maybe even 200 feet off of your breakwater, certainly off of your marina entrance, where boaters are in peril. And so you want to minimize that effect as best you can because they are, what are they doing? They're slowing down. They're about to come in. What happens when the boat slows down? It loses steerage. All of a sudden, a boat that's going straight may find itself being turned sideways, beamed to the sea. everything gets rougher. So you want to minimize the impact of this agitation that's happening at your structure, at your entrance. How do we do that? Well, there certainly is a what I'm going to call an approach corridor. There's a general area where all your boaters are going to either exit from or enter from. That's everything is confined there. If you have waves, and this can happen with currents too, if you have waves that are approaching the shoreline, they are going to reflect, and all of these are going to bounce right back into this area. You want to make those go away. So what do you want to do? Here's an example of a breakwater. This is a crib style. It's vertical sheet pile. It'd be very, very common that you'd see this sort of a breakwater. Additional features are added right at the entrance so that that kind of breaks up that reflective wave action. So these are preventative steps that you want to do in order to minimize the danger to boaters as they're trying to make an entrance. Now, if it's a floating attenuator, maybe you do something different with your floating attenuator there so that it eats up more wave energy. Maybe you change its angle of direction. Maybe instead of reflecting this way, you can turn it and make it reflect the waves a different way. There are many games that you can play, but there is a concern, a safety concern, that you want to integrate and solve in your design. So you want to add wave absorption near the entrance and limit the amount of reflections that can happen there. Now, how do we want to look at needs for boats coming in and out of your marina? Well, for power boats, and I just mentioned this, you get very poor steerage and following waves. Does anyone understand why that might be? I want you to think of the rudder on a boat as an airfoil. And that's what it is. It has lift as air moves across the top of it, and that causes an airplane to take off. Well, all of it, that's because air is being forced over that rudder fast, and that causes the lift. Same thing, that's actually what turns a boat. Water runs around the rudder faster on one side than it does the other, and literally, instead of you thinking of the power from the propeller pushing against the rudder and pushing the boat sideways, actually the rudder is sucking the stern of the boat to one side. So the boat is literally flying every time it turns by the stern being sucked to one direction. Well, if all of a sudden you have a following sea, that negates the water coming off the propeller. And now it's static, and just like an airplane would stall if it wasn't going forward, a boat will stall and lose all the steerage. So what you need to do is you need to make sure that when you have vessels entering or exiting, but most importantly entering a marina, that you set it up so that that direction is not a direction that has waves typically coming from the stern. You want to kind of skew it off 45 degrees. You have the same kind of consideration if you have sailboats. Sailboats have almost the opposite kind of issue. Sailboats do not do well when the wind is blowing right at them. In order to go forward, a sailboat has to tack back and forth so that it has some sort of relative angle between the wind and the vessel itself. So, again, you want to try and get some sort of maybe a 45-degree angle with whatever winds, maybe the prevalent winds directions that you have, so that sailboats can get in and out of your entrance under wind power with reasonable safety. So, generally, you want to be designing your marina approach for quartering seas, quartering winds. If you have the opportunity to select where and how you're going to put your marina entrance, you want to set it up by looking at a windrose, looking at a wave rose, and saying, if things are coming this way, my entrance needs to go this way. We want to make sure also that when we do not allow maneuvering requirements right through an entrance. We do not want to have a situation that we are forcing a boat to make a turn right in the entrance. Again, we have low steerage, low maneuverability, and now we are potentially, if we are forcing that boat to have to make a turn right in the entrance, we are risking the boat turning in a beam sea. It can turn turtle. The general guidance is, if you can make this happen, that you want to allow for at least a straight run of a vessel coming into your harbor of at least 5 times the boat length. So it can make a turn, I'll give it time to straighten out, run for about 5 times the boat length, and then it can make another turn. Otherwise, the driver is having to oversteer and try to get himself in very quickly and out of trouble. Very difficult situation. What do we want to know about the harbor entrance criteria? Well, for sure, we want waves less than 3 feet. 1 meter for those of you from Canada. Currents, if we have tidal currents flow in and out, we want that under 3 knots. 3 knots is kind of a magical number because that is the minimum speed at which we can maintain steerage with a rudder. So if you have currents greater than 3 knots, we actually may lose any sort of steerage capability through an entrance. We want water depth greater than 10 feet. There's a big reason for doing this. The first reason is that waves break. That's no surprise to anybody. I will tell you that waves break when the wave height is about 60%, 70% of the water depth. So it says, if I have 10 feet of water, I might have a breaking wave in my entrance that is 6 feet high, 2 meters high. So we are already getting well above our criteria, but I will say that no boater would ever anticipate or intentionally be out in the lake, out on the open water, in waves bigger than 6 feet. Probably have no business being out there bigger than 3 feet. But 6 feet is kind of really an upper end that anyone who got into trouble would be trying to make it in. So we want to make sure that we have a situation where we don't have waves breaking right in our entrance that are, you know, greater than 3 feet. If our water depth is deeper than 10 feet, the waves will not have broken. So we can now make an entrance into the marina in an unbroken wave condition. So let's kind of now look at some navigation considerations and why we have to do what we do there. Hard to believe that your marina really is dependent upon how people drive a boat, but that's at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. The first consideration is, why do we select the channel widths that we do? Well, while a lot of people drive their boats as if it's a car, I will tell you that boats do not steer and handle the way cars do. The normal assumption is that a boat can go straight ahead, a nice straight line, everything works great. The reality is, because we are steering from the back, that we have, as soon as we execute any sort of turn maneuver, it is the stern, not the bow, that turns. And as soon as we do that, we start getting what they consider an unstable moment, and the boat will start kind of making a wavy motion through the water. So you get this, there's a slow response time with the boat. Except for a very skilled boatsman, the natural tendency then is to turn the wheel back the other way to try and compensate, kind of like sliding on ice. That's same sort of situation. You start skidding, so you turn the wheel the other way, and sometimes you can make it worse. This is what happens here. So inevitably, you need not only just the width of the boat, but you need to allow for the fact that your boat is actually doing one of these things. And it does. We typically assume that the minimum width, just to allow for that irregularity in steerage, is at least 30% of the beam. And that's under an ideal situation. That's just related to the inherent flaws and abilities in steering the boat. If you have any influence of winds or currents or waves, we kind of crank that up that you need probably another 50% of your beam. That defines that zone which your steerage is going through. Now, I don't want to say it's doing it like this. These undulations may take place over many tens to hundreds of feet, but they are very real, that the boat is not going in a straight line. It is going through these maneuvers. And it could be almost as much as twice the width of the vessel is actually the required safety water zone for a vessel. You'll see a couple of different guidelines. Basically, we say if you have two-way traffic, you need to allow for, here we go, we're using that guidance for twice the width of the vessel, just to say that's its maneuvering lane, because it's doing that little ziggy-zaggy thing through it. We want to add an additional beam width of the vessel in between. And all of this has to take place within what we consider navigable depth. So when you look at a photograph and you say, my channel is 120 feet wide, that's not the navigable water depth. The navigable water depth may only be 80 or 90 feet because there's usually side slopes. So recognize that. Now, understand that you may, most of the time, be dealing with two-way traffic. However, on occasion, you may have a mega yacht, something very large come through, and it may behave as one-way traffic. So you don't necessarily always have to design for your largest vessel in a two-way traffic zone, because there's typically not as many large vessels. You can design a channel considering your normal reasonable size vessels and just make sure that one-way traffic for a very large vessel is possible. So our guidance then is clearance for a channel width needs to be at least 5 times the beam width, and depending upon how much poor steerage we may experience, we may be up to as much as 9 times the beam. And then if you happen to have boats moored along the side, recognize that this is the navigation channel. You have to add in the additional width of the moored vessels on the sides if you have those. This kind of explains a little bit further what happens when a vessel turns. We've talked about oversteerage. We've talked about the fact that vessels turn and steer from the rear. Here is a vessel that has both steerage at the stern and it has bow thrusters. The center of the vessel is not the pivot point that a vessel turns. The vessel actually turns at a point that's like 2/3 of the way from the stern. So the best that you can do to try and spin is that you'll end up with a circle that's about 130% of the length of your boat. That's about as fine of a maneuver as you can execute. And so when you're looking at, now this is a very long barge. This is not something that you would ever see in your marina, I don't believe. Although some of you may have commercial traffic that also either comes into your marina or may be adjacent to it. They require a fair amount of turning capability. Because in this case here, we've got a barge coming around the curve. It actually has to overswing its stern way out here in order to bring its bow back into position. So whenever we have a bend, we have to allow for the fact that this thing does not pivot perfectly about the center and just follow the line. In fact, its stern always will swing out into the curve, whether you choose to cut the corner this way or whether you allow it to swing this way. So bends have to naturally be as much as, actually, by the time you put this allowance on both sides, another 40% to 50% of the channel width. So let's look at two different generic marinas. And for talking purposes, for my next few slides, let's assume that they both have exactly the same number of boats in them, of exactly the same sizes. So we're going to pretend these are two identical marinas. And if we want to plan these, this particular dockage layout is what I'm going to call traditional, and I would venture to say 90% of all the marinas out there that you own and operate probably look or some variation of that, with a bunch of fingers that come off the shoreline. This is an alternate scheme, which I call a tree. Sometimes we call it a Christmas tree, where instead of having a bunch of docks coming from shore, we simply have two center main docks, and then we have a bunch of laterals. So I think you can see the tree analogy here. So we have two different kinds of marinas. Now, let's say that they both experience the same winds blowing from the offshore, and they experience the same kind of wave action coming against the breakwater. So they're both exposed to exactly the same environment. Well, what does that tell us when we've got these two different arenas? First thing is, let's look at loads and agitation that might happen on your docks. If you have boats moored in your slips, if we look at wind loads on those, it turns out that if a boat is the wind or wave, but in this case we're going to use wind, comes directly at the head or the stern, we have what they call a direction factor, the influence, how much area the wind is blowing on. We're just going to use that a factor of one. If I go over here to 90 degrees, the wind force is suddenly three times as big as it is if I've got winds blowing this way, I have three times as much force on my dock as if the winds blow this way. Here's our kind of guy. Our winds perpendicular to our boats moored in the marina are three times if they are parallel with the wind. Same way, if I look at a breakwater and I say, how high do I have to build a breakwater because I have a bad storm environment? If I have a 10-foot wave with a freeboard of 8 feet, I'm getting a transmission of about 20% into the marina. On the other hand, if I have a freeboard of 13 feet, okay, so here's my 13 feet out here. Now I get a lesser transmission. This is all going to come into the mathematics of how much you're going to spend on your marina. So if we base our calculations on, first, how we moor our vessels, does this marina have a bigger expense for piling or anchors, or does this one? Anyone have the one on the left? Probably three times as much expense for mooring.
Okay.
If I say that if I have boats tied up this way, that they are able to accommodate more agitation than if they're tied up this way, then which breakwater do I want? I want a lower breakwater, or I could have a lower breakwater. But let's just to kind of explore some other economics in here. The first consideration is, just from a power perspective, in this arrangement, all my big boats are out on the T-heads, and probably I have major electrical transformers on land or close to land for every one of these docks. Because this is where my big boats are, so I have to big power service all the way out on each one of them. On the other hand, in this scheme, my big boats are probably sitting out here, or in this particular case, they're right here. I have just two transformers that I require, bringing big power out right into the middle of the marina. And that big transformer is located right where my power hogs are. So are six or seven transformers to feed the same number of slips, or two transformers the more economic way to go? There's a third consideration, and that is a social-based marina layout. People tend to kind of view all their docks as neighborhoods, and they have their friends. Now, in this scheme, if your friend has his or her boat over here, your boat's over here, if you want to go visit your friend, you got to go down here through security, cross the land, back through security again, and back out again. Versus in a Christmas tree, you can stay within security and communicate back and forth with the neighborhood. So we are finding layouts like this to be more socially desirable than having a bunch of shore parallel kinds of docks. Or not shore parallel, shore perpendicular kinds of docks. So, which is the best least cost? I would argue if you have the opportunity to do something like this, try to do things with few in a tree sort of arrangement is a far more efficient and desirable way. You're going to pay less for pilings, pay less for anchor chains. You're going to be able to build a breakwater lower because the boats are now moored so that they're facing into any waves that come over versus these all being beam side on, so they're experiencing more roughness. So all of these kind of point to this potentially being the most efficient and desirable marina layout. But let's look particularly at our basin agitation concerns. If you look at the Corps of Engineers, who are the experts on many things, their recommendation says that they do not want to see slips be agitated by more than a foot of wave height 10% of the time. That's their guideline. And we're going to have access channels are 2 feet or more 10% of the time. Well, what is 10% of the time? Yeah. If you have a seasonal marina, so maybe you have maximum 4 months of really usable time, you are saying that 2 weeks of your whole boating season, which is only 4 months long, is going to be exceeding what is a recommended guideline. If you happen to have an all-season marina, kind of southern climates, 5 weeks, more than a month of the year, you're going to have an unacceptable environment in your marina. Plus, this criteria does not recognize the significance of boat wakes and harbor chop and other types of boating activities that may be going on. This is just really looking at boats sitting at the slip. So there have been criteria that have tried to go a lot deeper in this, and they've looked at what are better guidelines if you're worried about a weekly event, a yearly event, or the extreme storm 50-year event. They also have looked at whether your boats are moored in what they call a head sea condition, which means they are pointing into the waves, or if they are moored in a beam sea condition, if they're turned sideways to the waves. And I was alluding to that earlier when I was talking about selecting preferred breakwater heights. I want you to look at the difference, particularly here. If you are moored into the waves, it kind of says, on a weekly basis, a half a foot. On the other hand, if you're in a beam sea condition, it's a quarter of a foot. How many of you can honestly say that on a daily basis that you don't have more than 3 inches of waves in your marina? Probably not many. That is really the criteria that we are looking at for if you happen to have moored your boats in such a way that they are sideways to the waves coming in or sideways to the wind coming in. For comparison, this is this one-year event. This is what the more advanced study says that compares against what the Corps had already talked about. And again, you can see that this guidance is you can get much more agitation, acceptable agitation, safe agitation, if you moor in a head sea condition, which is the 1 foot that the Corps talks about, versus a beam sea mooring, which is only a half a foot. It's really important to think about how, if you have the opportunity, or if you're making a change in your dockage, how you want to point your docks. It has huge agitation values, and those all trickle down to cost and savings. The scariest part of all is recognizing that our docks are floating systems, or at least the boats in there clearly are floating systems. I want you to look even closer now at this table. Now these are expressed, these numbers are in feet, those are in meters, so let's look at the parentheses. Those are the lengths of boats, broken down by sizes. I want you to look at the head sea and the beam sea guidance, and notice that there is a magical wave period that says we really cannot have much agitation at all. And that's because all of these boats have a natural response period of around 3 seconds. Just like if you're driving down the road and your tires are out of balance and you get up to 50 miles an hour and everything starts shaking. Well, that's exactly the same thing happens because all boats, regardless of their size, have a natural heave period in the range of 3 to 4 seconds. So if you are experiencing waves in those periods, you need to even lower your agitation more. You want to get rid of as much wave action in that wave period range as possible. If you are using a floating attenuator, this is the kind of criteria you're trying to design for, because the attenuator is also floating. It's not going to do well. You want to try and get as much wave action out as you can, far less than what the core says 1 foot is acceptable. You're going to do this because you're going to try to save the wear and tear on the boats. You're going to try and save wear and tear on your docks, your cleats, your electrical systems, because they are going to tend to try and tear themselves apart if you allow too much agitation in that range. So our most stringent criteria that we need to, as owners, operators, and designers, think about is if you have a wave climate in 3 to 4 second periods. Now here is our guidance and a quick comparison between what happens if you have a good versus head seas versus beam seas. This is for what we consider good. You'll notice that we can live with, even in a severe storm event, we can live with something up to 2 feet in height if you have moored your vessels in a head sea direction versus still less than 1 foot in a beam sea. That's a huge difference. And all of this plays into the cost of anchorage, the cost of your insurance, the size of a breakwater, everything is in there. So layout is the most crucial thing you need to do when you're planning a marina or planning a change to a marina. You need to think not that I need a breakwater and not that I need docks. I need a marina and it has to work as a system. And then this just happens to be further guidance if you have other degrees, angles other than just exactly head on or to the side. So we want to understand now the form and scale of protection we need. Sometimes we may need a rock kind of structure. We need something big and massive to stop the storm waves. In other cases, the environment might be such that we could do something with a floating wave attenuator. You cannot assume that you can use that solution, nor should you assume that you have to automatically go to this solution. This has many permitting challenges to it. This one has performance challenges to it. So every site has to be reevaluated to see what your options are. But what I want you to start thinking now is the physical size of these structures that you need. Because we tend to think of things only in terms of, oh, here, it's a simple little wave that's running past. What does it look like? Well, here's an example where I have actually created a wall in the middle of a wave field. Now, what did I tell you before? That a common wave length is 100 feet? So I want you to keep that in your mind for a moment. I made this thing be 25 feet wide. Or this dimension is 25 feet then. So that's like that's a common finger on a dock. Do you think that the wave sees that finger at all? It doesn't. And that's even actually something that's solid all the way to the bottom. So let's look at this one now. Here I've made it be half of a wavelength, 2 fingers. That's a T-head for many docks. And again, that's solid all the way to the bottom. Do you think the wave even cares or sees that it's there? No. Let's see if we can get this guy to play. Now I have made my structure be a full wavelength in width. So we're talking about something 100 feet wide. Now finally, there's a little bit of a shadow appearing. Now, I don't want you to think that because the wave didn't see this thing up here, that there was no force on that wall. The wave was creating a huge amount of force on that wall. But it was the structure itself was transparent to the wave. We are talking about needing things physically at least a wavelength and width in order to be able to influence the wave field and create protection. Even here at a full wavelength and width, we are still getting almost half of the wave height reappearing on the backside. So a 3 or 4 foot wave out there is still a 2 foot wave in the shadow of this thing. And this is a solid wall now. So I want you to appreciate the scale it takes to stop and influence a wave. Our narrow structures have no effect. So thinking now three-dimensionally. Now, if you own this one of these slips right out here, you'd probably say, oh, look at that breakwater. I am well protected. Well, I want you to see what's happening here. We have waves coming this way. They are going right past here. They are bending a little, and they're headed right into that slip. So, why is that? Well, it's a little thing called wave diffraction. And if this is the breakwater right along here, it turns out this is the amount of wave height that actually can leak behind a breakwater. We just saw it physically happen. I'm telling you the numbers. I'm telling you that even with this whole structure right here, that 50% of that wave height can get to that guy right there. That's a lot. So even though this might graphically have appeared to be a well-planned, well-designed breakwater, this was inadequately considered when worrying about slips that far into the basin. Now, we do have some interior accessibility things we want to think about as well. You will always hear the guideline that you want your fairway to be start out with something like 150% of the length of the boat that using a slip. That's kind of a standard that everyone uses. And I've actually gotten on the CAD to make sure that this rule of thumb that we've always had really worked. And it does. That's nice. If a vessel backs out, executes a little J-turn, and these are recognizing realistic turn radiuses on most boats that don't happen to have bow thrusters and all the other accessories. Just a standard single rudder vessel. It can make this maneuver within 150% of the length of the boat. But if you have an aid, if you have a bow thruster, if you have twin screws, something like that, you can actually execute that turn in 130% of your wave, of the length of the boat. Now, this is kind of matches up with the turning circle thing that we saw imaged earlier. What is really interesting is we are now seeing bow thrusters starting to appear on yachts as small as 40 feet. Now, that's not unusual at all anymore. What does that mean for you guys? It means you can put more boats in your marina. If we are willing to step away from the traditional, I have to have 150% fairway length, and start recognizing that modern vessels now, we've had a change in the industry, they now have greater steerage capability. If I can trim space out of those fairways, which is non-revenue generating space, if I can do it, you can get more marine slips in there. Now, you still have to accommodate vessels that don't have that. You got to think about that. But there are opportunities here. And now we also have the rule for the case, well, we call it rough water, would require a much bigger turn. I think this is also called the drunk Sunday boat driver guideline. You need to accept the fact that there are going to be a few who just simply don't know how to drive a boat, and they need all the room in the world to get into those slips. If you have a situation where you have a bunch of side ties and you're trying to be able to maneuver a vessel out of a side tie position, and he wants to turn himself to go back out. We need something like 6 times the beam width clear between those two to execute that. The alternative is you can actually live with a narrower fairway as long as you provide a turning circle at the end of the fairway. You can't sell these slips as real slips then, that you have to leave a space for a turning circle, but you can live with a narrower fairway by allowing vessels to come down, execute a turning circle, which we have now learned is 130% of the boat length, and then they can get back out again. And then the last thing I'd like to talk about is water quality marina. We don't talk about that a lot, but that really, in today's concerns, that drives all sorts of regulatory approvals. And quite frankly, if you listened to the lectures yesterday, you heard that it drives the marketability of marina. Your users want to see clean water out there. They don't want to have smelly water. They don't want to have foul-looking water. They want things clean. So thinking about how do we get the best water quality on marina is both a market thing and a regulatory thing. We have done studies, and we understand now that what you want to do is have a marina basin that has an ability to self-clean itself as much as possible. And that typically happens if you have a basin shape. Now, this shows it a square, but I just want you to think of it in terms of a ratio between length and width that is on the order of 1:1. You kind of want forgive me for using the word squarish basin, but a proportional one to say. You certainly don't want something elongated that is more than 2:1. With that, you have the better ability for water to exchange and clean itself out. Here's kind of an example. The dark spots show the water that just won't leave, kind of get trapped in there. If you have a basin that's proportions are closer to 1:1, yeah, you have some dead corners, but it flushes very well. By going out to, this is about like 3:1, and lo and behold, there's a big part of your basin that the water just never changes. Trash starts accumulating there, fish die there because there's no oxygen exchange. It gets a little smelly down there. So you don't want to have elongated basins if you can help it. You want to kind of look at how long it takes for a basin to clear out. The EPA says if it takes 4 days for you to totally turn the water over in your basin, that would be great. Probably fewer than 10% of all the marinas in the country can ever hope to achieve that, because you need a large tidal flushing action for that to happen. If you can turn the water over in 10 days in your basin, it's acceptable. And this is really what we can strive to get for. Greater than 10 days is they consider unacceptable, and now you're having to do aeration, different activities. But there are things that we can still do with our basin shape to kind of push ourselves up that scale a little bit if we have the opportunity to introduce them. One thing is that if we have a very square shape, we can do things to make it be more roundish. It doesn't have to be round, but we have to just do things that where we kind of round the corners a little bit. You can kind of see in this square shape, you've got dead water here, dead water here. Well, maybe all we needed to do was just round that corner enough, and that will give us a very good exchange. Water comes in, it rolls all the way around to the basin, and it goes back out again. This is an ideal scenario. I went the wrong way there. There's also questions. Here's actually showing an example. The flushing of a square basin versus a round one. I want you to kind of look at the patterns in between, and you can actually see that this thing that is more teardropped actually has the ability to reach all the way in and clean out the basin much easier than something with a square shape in here. So to the extent that we can introduce some sort of roundness to it, really helps water quality. The entrance size, interestingly enough, affects water quality. It turns out almost perhaps contrary to your best guess, that a narrower marina entrance actually flushes better than a very wide entrance. How many of you would have guessed that one? I would not. I'll be the first to put my hand up. I would have assumed wide entrance, just easy flow in and out. But in fact, what we're doing when we have a narrow entrance is we kind of force the water to work like a jet. And that jet actually blows through the marina and cleans it out much easier. So these are three different marinas, but you can see the change going from maybe 10% of the dimension to 20% to this is maybe up to 40%. Look at how much is dead water here compared to what's dead water there. A narrow marina entrance is actually beneficial to you for water quality. There's a question of whether double entrances help on the flushing. Here's two basins, one with a single entrance. Here someone thought, well, let's put a double entrance in there and see what that does for improving our circulation. Lo and behold, the single entrance actually performs better again because we're forcing the water to move around it and clean out the entire basin. In this case, the water goes in and it short circuits and comes right back out the other side, and the inner portions of the marina don't flush. If you have a very long marina basin, with two entrances, the middle part just never gets touched. These things almost start behaving like independent units, and the middle water gets poor quality. So all of these things go into the geometry and planning and layout of your marina if you think about them in advance. Finally, there's the question of, should an entrance be offset or should it be in the middle? And it's my judgment that offset entrances are far more efficient in achieving water quality than an entrance that happens in the middle. You can make your own judgment, but that's my opinion. Then there's always the regulator rule. I will guarantee you that no matter where you are, a regulator says, I want you to put some culvert pipes through your breakwater so that water will flush better. And you look at it and you say, that's going to cost me a lot of money to do that. So here is actually a study. This is actually the same study of the flushing examples you were just looking at, where in fact two culvert pipes were introduced into the model. And you can see the influence of the flushing happening here, coming in the entrance. I want you to look at the zone of influence of that culvert that was added. It has a local effect of maybe 10 or 15 feet, and after that, it's transparent. I will tell you that culverts, and this is a like a big 6 foot by 6 foot box culvert. I'm not talking about a little pipe. This is a big culvert. I will tell you that these things just do not have the cross-sectional area to do you any good. It is a waste of money. And in fact, if you made this thing too big, now we'd be getting into almost a double marina entrance, and we've just seen that doesn't work as well as a single marina entrance. So recognize that the effects are limited, and it's a waste of money. So if we throw all these things together, we're going to work with changing the aspect ratio, trying to control that, keeping it as close to one as we can. We're going to play with its shape. We're going to try to introduce roundness. I'll tell you, the landscape architects are right on this. Engineers have a fundamental flaw. You knew that, didn't you? We have a fundamental flaw in that we cannot live with something that's not a straight line and a square corner. It makes us squirm at night. We can't sleep if the lines do this. That's just a problem with engineers. Landscape architects are right. They understand Mother Nature a little bit better. We want our basins to have roundest shapes. So we want to configure our marina for safety, efficiency, tranquility, environmental quality, and social enjoyment. So should the marina look like that? Or should the marina look like that? And Davey says, now you know why we've set the rules the way we have. can't talk over the music, right? Did I go too fast? Everyone follow what I'm saying there with it. I may have said a few controversial things, but I've learned a few things as I have become older and a little bolder. So, yeah.
How do you establish your beam?
How do I establish my beam? Beam for the vessel? With those, you're saying you have a mix of vessels? Okay, you have enumerated. Well, the first thing that someone will have done is you will have done some sort of market study that you will say, you know, I expect to have 30% of my boats are going to be 35 feet in length, 20% are going to be 40. We have inventories of different manufacturers' boats, and within a few inches we can say the beam of a 40-foot boat is this, the beam of a 35 is this. So we kind of have a database that we already know that. There is a book by Tobiasen and Kohlmeier. It was published, the second edition was published in about 94, so it's admittedly a little bit out of date, but it actually includes charts that give a relationship between vessel length and boat beam and boat draft. That is a good first starting place. Any other questions? Yeah, back here. Okay, the question was if we have a river channel situation, and should we have a double entrance if we have a river channel? The analysis done up there assumed essentially a river channel situation. So it's saying even though your intuitive feeling might be that a double entrance would give you better flow through, and it does give you good flow through. The problem is it's short circuits. It doesn't run fully into the basin. It just kind of hugs the nearest wall and goes back out again. So what we're trying to achieve is an entrance where we can jet the water in and make it sweep through the basin as much as we can. Well, thank you. Please stay for the next talk that my colleague Greg is going to charm you with more things. So thanks.